Maybe someday she'll come looking for you.
No, I'm not cut out for motherhood. Monica laughed.
Where should I take all this?
I pointed to the boxes we had packed.
To a dumpster. I never want to see any of it again.
I nodded, thinking of the several dumpsters along the park. We carried the boxes down the stairs to the parking lot.
I have a great idea, Monica said suddenly as we loaded the boxes into my car. Let's go out tonight. You can see Bruce's old club. We can dance and drink. Maybe flirt a little.
Can't. I'm having dinner with my mom.
Perfect. Bring her with you.
I frowned, thinking of my mom's response. I can try, I said. That night, I waited until it was full dark. Then I tossed Bruce's things into the dumpster on the park's western edge, working up a sweat and breathing heavily as each box sailed from my arms. The street lamps made the clear tape covering the boxes shimmer like ribbons of water. When I was back in the car, I caught sight of myself in the rearview mirror. The makeup had sweated off my face. My mouth and nose seemed fused together in a greenish column, and the almond-shaped corner of my right eye was plum red. My face, I realized, resembled some gruesome mask.
What will I do there? My mother asked. Everyone will think I'm some old lady.
She was at the stove in a terry cloth bathrobe and moccasin slippers, removing a whining tea kettle from the burner. Her hair was pinned behind her ears and her face was covered in shining skin cream.
You'll have fun. You can have a drink or two. It won't kill you.
My mother shot me a look as if to say it very well might kill her. She filled a mug with steaming water and carried it to the table.
Please, Mama. I pulled a chair beside her. You never go out.
That's not true. I am at the college 5 days a week. I take my walks. I go to church. I am always out, just not with you or your little friend downstairs. She ran her fingers along the mug's brim. The heat fogged her light pink polish.
Come on, Liz. It's silly.
I haven't been out at all. I sit here all day. I've done nothing.
You act like all this is my fault.
I remained silent, running my fingers along the rippled bridge of my nose.
Oh, fine, she said, but I won't stay long.
The mermaid room had a low stucco ceiling, an elevated square stage, and a black and white checkered floor. On stage, a sad girl in a satiny dress, a purple iris pinned to her hair, sang into a microphone.
Stormy weather, she sang, syrupy and sweet, since my man and I ain't together.
Monica was in a back booth, leaning over a clear drink with a lime. She wore a slinky sequin top that showed the notches in her ribcage between her breasts. Her eyes were closed and she nodded, humming and swaying to the music. She didn't look up as my mother and I scooted across from her and flung our purses into the booth's corner.
Damn, Monica said. How does someone so young know about so much pain?
She must pay attention to life, said my mother. Monica opened her eyes, grinned.
You made it, Mama Liz.
We ordered a round of drinks, my mother sticking to red wine as Monica and I sipped tequila. Monica wasn't her normal chatty self, so I asked what year the building was built, how long Bruce had owned it, where the band was from, if she could sing.
Oh, God, no. I'd bust someone's eardrums.
She can sing.
I lifted my drink toward my mother. Can't you, Mama?
Not like this girl. Not in a million years.
My mother adjusted the collar on her chiffon shirt, centering her crucifix necklace above her sternum, covering a black mole. Her gaze was on the singer, whose dress had a liquid sparkle that turned blinding when she twisted her body toward the right light. The bar erupted with applause as she exited the stage. She curtsied to the left, moving in a milky blur toward the bar. A quartet began setting up. Monica shuffled through her purse, pulling out a pack of cigarettes.
"Care to join?" she asked,
and I nodded. I stood on the sidewalk with Monica, smoking and listening to her talk about a bartender she used to date.
"God," she said, "and he always wanted me to be on top, like it was the fucking Olympics."
I laughed and blew smoke toward the bar. I could see my mother through the windows. She remained in the booth, resting her head against the cool wall, her dark hair spreading into shadows. She slowly sipped her wine, keeping her face to the table when a man in a fedora approached her. She tore a napkin to pieces and shook her head.
"Can you believe that singer?" Monica asked. "Will you stay for a second set?"
I told her I couldn't, that I needed to get my mother home. We finished our cigarettes, and when Monica opened the door, music fell into the street. In the distance, a storm gathered beyond the city, thin veins of lightning illuminating the sky. That night, the pelting sounds of rain covered my mother's snoring. I imagined her in the next room, her body a breathing lump beneath a white quilt. For the first time since I had come home, I thought of how lonely she must be. Each day she focused on tasks instead of herself. I wondered if she had ever tried to date a man from the college, a divorced professor, perhaps. I rolled onto my side and fell asleep, where I dreamed of my father. "I'm going ice fishing," he said. I told him I loved the ice houses. He kissed my forehead and I felt his shape, solid and stifling. He brought me to the lake. We carved a hole into the ice, and he reached inside the black water until he was snagged like a fish caught on a hook. The hole grew larger as he screamed, and I feared that when it was done with him, that darkness was coming for me. That's when I woke up and looked at my phone. 3:17 a.m. I had 5 missed calls, all from Monica. She was outside our lobby in her white SUV with tinted windows and leather seats. Monica kept the motor running as I got inside.
"Let's go for a drive."
I shook rain from my hair. My mom might wake up and get scared if I'm gone.
"It's not like you sleep in her bed. How will she know you're not there?"
"I'm her child," I said. Monica drove us down narrow one-way roads, weaving in and out of alleys. The rain fell in slanted white lines. The radio was low on an AM station. Someone was talking to someone else about bees and honey. There were hardly any headlights on the road.
"Did you have fun tonight?" Monica asked.
"Bruce's old bar is cool. I like the vibe."
"It never changes. Different bands play, different girls sing, but it always feels like home."
Monica turned off the main road and stopped the SUV. Her headlights beamed outward until they fell upon a set of stone pillars. We were in the lot beside the park's pavilion.
"You know, he chased me for years."
Monica lit a cigarette. The flame cast upward shadows on her face.
"I used to make fun of him. I told people he was just some old pervert."
She rolled down the window, exhaling smoke in a hurried line. Her slinky top darkened as rain fell sideways onto her arms and legs, some of it making its way onto my face, the unmistakable warmth of Colorado rain in summer.
"Once we were together, I hoped people realized it was about love, not that other stuff, money or convenience."
I asked her what people she was talking about. She carried on without an answer.
"He wanted a baby. Give me a little girl," he'd say. I heard him crying in the shower about it. This huge man beneath that running water crying. And now that he's gone.
Monica faced me. She raised her voice and it broke.
"I only want him back."
Between the low chatter on the radio and the constant thumping of rain, it was easy to remain silent as Monica began to cry. Her profile was sharply lit by little lights inside the car. She seemed calm despite the tears rolling off her jaw and into her chest. In that chaos, the heavy fog of breathing, the sounds of a storm, I saw Monica check her reflection in the rearview mirror. From beneath her seat, Monica then handed me a flask and told me to drink. I could be anyone, I thought, and she would still say these things. Monica didn't want help or comfort. She wanted to be seen. Take me back home, I said, raising my voice. My mom will worry. Monica continued sobbing, throwing her arms around, waving to nobody. Beyond the fogged windows, I stared into the black spaces between the stone pillars. I wanted to go home and crawl into bed. I wanted to wake up and see my mother off before she left for work. We'd have black coffee with fried eggs. She'd encourage me to get out of the house, leaving an umbrella for me in case I decided to walk. That's when I saw the man. On the curb, before the stone pavilion, his head was slumped and he appeared to be sleeping upright in a shiny leather jacket. That guy, I said, pointing to the windshield. He shouldn't be out here in the rain. What guy? She asked, and when I pointed again, Monica opened the door and, with me following her, ran through the rain. We were a few steps away when I realized it was the homeless man. He was sitting on the sidewalk with a fifth of whiskey, water drizzling down the grooves of his wrinkles. When he saw us approaching, he smiled deliriously and lifted the half-empty bottle. A swig, he said, for you, the beautiful ladies. Monica was stunned, like she was seeing a ghost, but it was the image of someone else in her dead husband's jacket. She knocked the whiskey from the homeless man's hand, breaking the bottle at my feet. The amber-colored liquid instantly swallowed by the sidewalk and the early morning rain. We don't need roughhousing, the homeless man said. You wasteful girl. Monica yanked his left arm. This is my husband's jacket. The homeless man said nothing. He opened and closed a fist as though muscle memory was forcing him to reach for the bottle. You dug it out of the trash, Monica yelled, didn't you? Like a dog. The homeless man frowned, muttering something about being thirsty, and Monica grabbed a fistful of his hair. He let out a howl. Stop, miss, please. I wasn't causing you harm. Monica's face relaxed as something went blank in her eyes. It was a look I had seen countless times in my father's face. Monica jerked the homeless man's neck with both hands. She toppled him onto his side, letting out the dull boom of a body on concrete. With the tip of her pointed heel, she kicked him in the gut, the face, anywhere she could. The homeless man wailed in agony. Monica lifted her leg to kick him once more, but I kneeled beside him to block her blows. Her foot lodged itself into the small of my back, sending me forward until my face was an inch from the homeless man's. He was crying, the grooves in his face drenched with rain. I pleaded for Monica to stop. I gave it to him, I said. I saw him at night without a coat. I had the boxes in my car. I wanted him to be warm. Monica paused her kicking. The homeless man removed one arm from the jacket sleeve and then the other, tossing the coat onto the curb, where it rested like a dog's tongue. He shivered in a sodden flannel, soaked to his skin. I leaned down to him and whispered soothing lies that everything would be all right. The homeless man looked at my face, his eyes webbed in bloody veins. Someone hurt you, he said. They hurt you bad. I walked home in the rain and stayed in the shower for a long time. Wrapped in a towel, I leaned in the doorway of my mother's bedroom. Silently crying, I watched as she slept. Not long before I left California, my mother called just to chat.
I've been looking at some photos of myself, she said. Mostly from when I was with your father. I'm a little embarrassed.
Why's that?
I can tell how sad I look. It's something in my eyes. There's this dull light inside them. I'm starting to wonder if it's always been there. If I looked that way before your father, when I was a teenager, or even a little girl.
You just have dark eyes, I said. Plenty of people do. I know I do.
No, it's different.
What happened to me that made me look so sad? She laughed, and I heard her sipping from a glass.
I get embarrassed. I kept wondering how many people recognized that sadness in me.
Probably more than I'd like to know.
But it changed.
I asked her how, pulling the phone a little away from my ear, holding up a finger, and letting the man in my bed know it wouldn't be much longer.
The world did. It became less urgent, somehow bigger, and I didn't worry so much about being loved.
Tomi. Read for you by Kyla Garcia. When my nephew Tomi was a baby, I stole the $1,000 his mother Natalie kept in her closet. It was for his college fund. She had placed the money in a rinsed-out mason jar, wrapped in a knockoff Fendi scarf and hidden beneath a pile of bald socks. Hungover and dazed, I crept across their carpeted floor, taking the jar and spending everything on liquor and clothes within a week. Natalie always suspected it was me, though Manny said I would never do something like that. Who, he demanded, would steal from their own blood? 6 years later, I stole a 94 Honda Civic and drove head-on into an elderly couple's picture window at 4 in the morning. It was in the northern suburbs. Every house and driveway looked like a white gravel road. An old man wore striped pajamas as he dusted shattered windshield glass from my face. Blood flooded my mouth, a tooth dragged down my throat. The old man placed a towel on my lips and told his wife to call an ambulance. When he leaned back through the car door, his pajama arm resting on the steering wheel, he said, "Look at you, Hita. You're just a baby." I served my time at La Vista Correctional Facility in Pueblo, Colorado. My family didn't call much, and they never visited. I marked the days on 2 calendars. The first filled with illustrations of wildflowers, and the second with photos of horses in empty rustic fields. Toward the end of the horses, my attorney wrote to say that I was up for early release, so long as I had a place to live and I got a job. I planned on moving into a halfway house off Colfax Avenue when Manny called to say I could live with him and Tomi. "Won't Natalie be pissed?" I asked Manny over the phone. "She's gone. She left me." I told him I was sorry, even though I had seen it coming. At 17, Natalie had moved into our house with only a snap-closed suitcase, 2 Navajo blankets, and her belly full of Tomi. "Why are you doing this?" I asked Manny before hanging up. "You're my sister, Cole. My blood. But please don't fuck up this time." When he was 21 and I was 15, Manny inherited our family home after our father died of a heart attack while shampooing his hair. Our mother was already long dead. When I was very little, she swallowed an entire bottle of painkillers. At La Vista, I read in an anatomy book that the heart has no nerve endings, and for a little while, I believed my parents died without any pain. We lived on Denver's north side in the shadow of Mile High Stadium, a neighborhood that was now called Highlands, though only white people said that. Our house was a slender brick square that rested on a high plot, giving it the illusion of something great among knifing condos and black BMWs. The gentrification reminded me of tornadoes, demolishing one block while casually leaving another intact. Our block, Vallejo Street, was unrecognizable. I was released from La Vista early on a Tuesday morning in late autumn. Manny met me outside in his white Tacoma that reeked of corn chips and coffee. He wore his canvas Carhartt, his dark hair newly streaked white. "Look at you," he said, pinching my cheeks. "Someone called Jenny Craig." "Yeah, prison don't have any Bud Light. Damn shame. I'll get you some chicharrones for the road." He turned up the radio on a Neil Young song and beat out the chorus on the steering wheel. A red rosary dangled snake-like from the rearview mirror. Taped to the dash were Virgin de Guadalupe prayer cards and a Sears baby picture of Tommy. "How is he?" I asked, brushing the photo with my hand. "Since Natalie's been gone." "I don't know. Sad." Manny pinched tobacco into his left cheek. "He's failing a class called Read and Relax. You tell me how a person fails to read and relax." We drove by a yellow traffic sign, bullet-holed and bent, warning against picking up hitchhikers when near a correctional facility. The sky beyond was larger than I'd ever seen, an oily gray with arrowheads of birds. "Impressive," I said. Manny parked the Tacoma outside our house. I pointed to a glass high-rise that had appeared where a vacant warehouse once stood. It reflected the clouds, the wingtips of the mountains. "That's pretty fancy," I said.
"Yeah, real fancy. It also ruins my view of the stadium. These property taxes are fucking me," said Manny.
"But we were here first. I'll be damned before I move to the suburbs." Inside, Tommy was on the living room floor, his hair a mop of black strands. He clutched a video game controller, swaying right and left, forward and back. His glasses were smudged with spotted fingerprints, reflecting the sparkling blue lights of the television. Manny hung his Broncos hat on the rack and unzipped his Carhartt. He had grown softer around his middle, and I wondered if I looked older, too.
"Get up," he said. "Say hi to your auntie."
Tommy flung forward. Video game blood splattered the screen.
"Hi to your auntie."
"Aye."
Manny walked over, swatting Tommy's head with his right palm.
"Don't act like such a shithead. She's traveled a long way, son."
Tommy looked at me, squinting with sarcasm.
"Why, hello, Auntie Nicole."
"Just call me Cole, Tommy."
"Really?"
Manny showed me to the windowless basement where I had stayed before La Vista. Everything was the same as when I left. The stench of mothballs, the hanging light bulb, my faded size 16 jeans stuffed into a cardboard box. I spotted my Kmart futon with a busted seam, and Manny gave the white aluminum frame a good shake.
"It won't be too comfortable. There aren't any pillows."
"Why not?"
"I think Natalie took them. I've looked everywhere. Tommy and I slept with our heads on folded towels last night. I shit you not. Towels."
"That's child abuse. Even the prison had pillows. Get some new ones."
"It's the principle of the thing. Natalie thinks she can take off like that, stealing sheets and pillows and whatever else I can't find around here."
I nodded and looked past him, studying a rippling crack in the cement wall. The room was as big as 4 cells at La Vista, maybe 5. "I got a nap.
I need to head back to the office anyway."
Manny handed me 2 stolen hotel towels for pillows and told me to enjoy. I woke up a couple hours later to the sounds of gunshots. Tommy was in the same position as before, seated on a leather sofa cushion like a little Buddha. On the television screen, things were being blown up. He kept his eyes to the TV when I said hello.
You woke me up, dude. I was trying to take a nap.
Tomi lurched forward with his video game controller, his mouth shiny with spit.
So, you're pretty big now, I said.
This was an understatement. He was the heaviest little kid I'd ever seen.
What are you playing?
Call of Duty?
What's that?
He glared at me.
You're not like how I remember. You were fat.
I was fat?
You sure you know what fat looks like?
He paused his game and twisted around to face me.
You were like a fat goth chick or something.
People change. Anyway, I was sleeping. Maybe turn down the volume or read a book. Quiet kid things.
Tomi rose from the cushion. I watched him walk to the kitchen in mismatched socks and oversized pipe shorts. He grabbed a carton of Sunny Delight from the fridge. He poured a glass, got himself some gushers from the pantry, and returned to his seat. He unpaused his game and blew up a helicopter.
You shouldn't be sleeping at 3 in the afternoon, he said. Only bums do that.
The next morning, I called my parole officer from Manny's house phone. She was an older woman from Nebraska named Charlie May and spoke with a slight lisp.
Now, Nicole, you need to start making some job contacts.
I've been home a day.
That's no excuse. It's already noon.
I'm not qualified for much.
Sure you are, she said. Find your niche. That thing you like.
At La Vista, I had taken enrichment classes. Some lady from the community college taught us how to make traditional Pueblo Indian pinch pots. Another woman visited with notebooks filled with nature sketches and tracings of dead birds. The class I liked most, though, was language arts. We read Lilies of the Field, and I had this clear picture of a little desert town. I liked going there, so I read the book more than once. I also loved biographies, especially about women inventors, like Betty Graham, who came up with Whiteout. I thought maybe I could do something like that, come up with my own inventions. But after I got out, I knew no one would have enough faith in me. That afternoon, I walked 3 blocks to 32nd Avenue. Blonde women with high ponytails pushed babies in expensive strollers, while white guys in khakis stared at their cell phones, sidestepping fallen leaves. I went into a tea shop that had once been a liquor store and handed the frizzy-haired redhead my resume. She wore beaded earrings and colorful New Age crystals around her neck.
You have experience with teas? She asked, her eyes looking out from delicate, wire-framed glasses.
Oh, yes, I said. I can steep the shit out of a tea bag.
She stared at me and cleared her throat.
We're not hiring.
I was back at Manny's, sitting in front of the empty fireplace, drinking a cup of chamomile tea in place of beer, when Tomi came home. Without noticing me, he stepped into the kitchen wearing earbuds. He opened the refrigerator, grabbed the Sunny Delight, tipped his head back, and guzzled. I gently yanked his earbuds.
Shouldn't you be at school?
He wiped his juice mustache on the back of his hand.
Shouldn't you be out getting a job?
For your information, I was out looking for jobs earlier. I grabbed a bottle of Sunny Delight.
This is gross. You know how many calories this has? Your dad shouldn't buy this. It's sugar water.
Whatever.
You should know. You used to be a fat goth cokehead.
I opened my mouth and lowered my eyebrows, pretending to be offended. Tomi didn't flinch. His little freckled moon face remained fixed in an angry scowl. I flicked his backpack strap and flung my index finger into the air.
Let's get something straight, Tomas Manuel Morales. One, I was not goth. I just liked purple lip liner. 2, I wasn't that fat. And 3, I wasn't a cokehead. If I was, I would have been skinny. Everybody knows that.
Tomi scrunched his face. A deep line formed between his eyebrows.
Are you going to make me go back to school?
Do you think he plays video games too much?
I asked Manny as he dug through the hallway closet, searching for a set of sheets. After tossing into the corner several pillow covers that our mother had crocheted, he stepped away from the shelves. There was a dusty cinnamon smell like our mother's hair, though it must have been a memory, something tricking my mind.
Christ almighty,
Manny said, his face hidden by the bill of a Rocky's hat, the slight shadow spreading down his flannel shirt like a bib. It was Saturday. That meant working around the house for Manny and nothing else. He removed his hat. He wiped sweat with his shirt sleeve from his forehead. He muttered something about Natalie taking the pillows and God knows what else. He then placed his hands on his lower back, letting out a groan.
Tomi is dealing with a lot right now. If it makes him happy to play some video games, I'm not going to take away his happiness. Let the boy be.
Does she even see him? I asked. Manny rubbed the stubble on his neck. He walked across the hallway until he stood beneath the attic door, unlooping its roped latch from its resting place.
No.
Honestly, I never liked Natalie. She's a selfish bitch. The truth was, in the beginning, I wanted to like her. I wanted her to be the sister I never had. But Natalie scared me. It wasn't unusual for her to fight when we were younger. She once shattered a dish across Manny's face when he'd embarrassed her at a cousin's birthday party. Manny pried open the attic. There was a cool and anxious draft.
Don't call my son's mother a bitch.
Some mother, I said, gathering the pillow covers from the floor and placing them back in the closet. That's when I caught sight of Manny's bedroom down the hallway, the door halfway open, revealing his unmade, pillowless bed. It was strange not having Natalie in the house. I once saw her on the edge of that bed, crying with strands of her black ponytail caught in her mouth.
You think this is what I want, Cole?
She had asked when our eyes met. She was 8 months pregnant with Tomi, and as she walked out of my sight, she resembled a little girl with a balloon tucked underneath her shirt, playing pretend.
I mean it about Tomi, I said after some time. It isn't right for a kid to sit inside all day. He should be out building a fort or finding dead bodies in the woods. You know, like in Stand By Me.
Manny started up the wooden ladder, his torso disappearing into the skull of the house.
Worry about getting yourself a job.
Tomi was on the sofa cushion, clicking the remote and staring at the blank TV screen. I sat on a recliner, pretending not to notice anything unusual. While he was at school, I had unplugged some cables from the wall. I hid them behind the elliptical in the basement, the one place he'd never look. Tomi walked to the TV, pushed some more buttons, and said,
Where are they?
I heard your mom jack the pillows. Why don't you ask her ass? Tomi looked defeated. He slumped forward and stared at his mismatched socks, wiggling a toe through a tiny hole. He wore a black t-shirt with flames and traced his plump index finger over the printed fire.
She's such a bad person.
All moms are crazy, I told him. I was about to go to the bookstore. Come with me? Tomi twisted his face while tapping his socked foot against the carpet. He threw his head around and rolled his eyes beneath his glasses.
Don't start convulsing, I said.
Whatever.
Do you want to go to the bookstore or not?
I can't believe you like to read,
said Tomi.
I was in prison. What do you think I did all day?
Tomi walked like a little boy lost in a world of wonder.
I was stunned by how at the edge of a pond, he reached up and gently held the dying leaf of a tree.
It had rained earlier. Clear beads of moisture clung to the branch. He snapped the leaf from its stem. Leftover water pelted our heads as Tomi threw the leaf to the sidewalk, crushing it with his enormous padded tennis shoes.
Did your mom ever take you on walks? I asked.
We used to, Tomi said. We'd go with Dad in the summer, before the sun went down.
I used to walk with my mom, too.
Grandma Louise?
I nodded. Did your dad tell you about her?
Yup. He said she made really pretty blankets.
I smiled. I told Tomi that was true.
Hey, Cole. Which room was yours growing up? Was it mine or the other one? The big room with the bathroom connected.
He was talking about the master bedroom, where my father had collapsed in the shower. It's also where my mother fell asleep when I was 8 years old and never woke up. No one stayed in that room anymore. There were too many ghosts. Manny used the room as storage, filled it with Christmas decorations, Tomi's old baby bassinet, seasonal junk.
I had your room, I said. Watch out. There might be goth crap hidden in the floorboards.
Tomi snickered.
Our room sucks. The big tree in the front yard blocks my view of everything.
It's not too bad. I thought of how I used to climb down from my window and onto that cottonwood tree as a teenager. Bottles of stolen tequila and a few stray beers in my backpack. My getaway tree.
Tomi strolled ahead, his jeans making jingling noises, as if he were a janitor carrying around keys to 1,000 rooms. It's the worst. When my mom left, I couldn't see her at all. I could hear her car and all that, but I couldn't see anything but those stupid leaves.
Where's your mom now?
She's with her new boyfriend, Ronald. She tried to take me over there, but I hated it. He smells like a ferret, and he's really into frisbee golf.
That's really weird.
It is really fucking weird. Watch it.
I lightly slapped the back of his head.
Don't cuss.
At the bookstore, I showed Tomi the teen section, an overflowing back corner with a dirty love seat. There were posters on the walls of 90s celebrities posing with copies of Beloved and Moby Dick. See, I told him,
even Buffy the Vampire Slayer likes to read.
When he asked who that was, I said never mind and told him to pick out a book. I walked to the entrance and thought of asking the clerk for an application, but I knew this wasn't the sort of place where they'd hire an ex-convict. After a little while, Tomi tapped my shoulder and presented me with a book. The cover image was of an exceptionally suntanned warrior descending a volcano as he thrust the bloody heart of a sacrificial victim into the air. Behind him, a bolt of white lightning illuminated the title, Azteca Moonrise.
It's a whole series, Tomi whispered. How many can I get?
I was released from prison with $200 and some change.
How about you get book one? If you like it, we'll come back for the second.
Nice. These books look badass.
Tomi sent the pages fluttering with his thumb.
Hey, Cole. I'm not retarded or anything.
I never said you were.
I know, but sometimes I get mixed up on words. My mom used to help, but she's busy playing frisbee golf now.
That sucks. You want my help? The next day after school, Tomi sat beside me at the kitchen table, his fleshy arms folded beneath his chin, Azteca Moonrise in front of us. We stayed for an hour, our necks bent over the pages, aching from marathon reading and sleeping without pillows. Tomi, I discovered, was a slow reader, to the point that it worried me. Over the next few days, I researched reading strategies online. Visualization, annotating. We tried them out, and within a couple weeks, Tomi actually showed improvement. He especially loved reading aloud. Whenever he got to a passage with a warrior sacrificing a virgin, Tomi passed the book to me.
"I like how you do the voices," he'd say, and I always thanked him,
reminding him that I played Rudolph in the La Vista Christmas pageant 2 years running. A few weeks after Tomi and I started reading Azteca Moonrise, Manny came home with a paper grocery sack and two shot glasses. He sat at the kitchen table and let out a drafty sigh. I curled my arm around the sofa's back to face him. From the paper sack, he pulled out a bottle of Hornitos and set it on the table with a clink. Manny twirled the bottle by its long neck, smirked.
"Got a sales bonus today. 500 bones.
Congratulations. Now get that shit out of here. What are the chances your PO will show?" I glared at Manny. "As good a chance as any other night. Take it out to your truck." I reminded him that as part of my early release, Charlie May could visit whenever she pleased. I could hear her voice saying, "No alcohol or other forms of contraband allowed in the domicile." I could go back to La Vista for a thimble of marshmallow-flavored vodka. Manny moved his hand around the tequila's top, as though he were unscrewing its cap. With the bottle still sealed, he poured imaginary shots. He licked the back of his left hand, dashed out some salt.
"Arriba abajo."
"You're crazy," I said, and joined him at the table. The bonus had nothing to do with Manny's desire to drink real or imagined liquor. He was in a wistful mood, reminiscing, talking about our parents and telling stories from back in the day.
"You were so damn scared," he kept saying,
about the time I fell from the cottonwood tree that my father had warned us against.
"One wrong move and you kids will break your necks."
Manny had rushed barefoot into the front yard, slicing open his heel on a broken bottle someone had tossed onto our lawn. As he carried me inside, he left bloody footprints on the hardwood floor. I looked over his shoulder at the shining red pools.
"Is it my neck?" I asked.
"No," he said. "It's mine." "I'm worried about Tomi," I told Manny after some time. "I think he has a problem. A reading problem."
"He's 11 and doesn't like to read. It's normal."
10, I said.
"What?
10. Tomi is 10. I studied Manny's face and wondered if he resembled our father at that age. Long lines trailed from the sides of his nose down to the edges of his mouth. His dark eyes were bright, though heavy with bags. At La Vista, I often pictured Manny as a little boy, his grave face and stern eyes, but he was never a child to me. Always the big brother, always the grown-up.
"Why didn't you visit me?" I said.
Manny dropped his gaze to his lap.
"Natalie didn't want to go. Said it wouldn't be good for Tomi."
"I needed you," I said softly. "I didn't want to see you in a place like that.
What do you want me to say?"
"That you're sorry?" Manny shook his head and poured another make-believe shot. He raised it to me.
"I swear on our parents' lives, if you ever drive a stolen vehicle while under the influence into a residential building again, I will visit you in prison."
I swallowed, attempting to calm my trembling throat.
"Shut up, asshole."
Tomi and I finished Azteca Moonrise on a Wednesday afternoon. We read the final page out loud together, and after the last line, Tomi looked at me, almost tearful, and said,
"Azteca starship awaits."
He pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose.
"Let's go to the bookstore right now."
I didn't have any cash left, and while I thought to ask Manny for help, I knew he'd just tell me to get a job.
"Let's try the library.
We can take the bus.
Every ride is an adventure."
"Yeah," Tomi said.
"For poor people."
"Well, I'm poor, and you're 10. That makes you poor by default." The bus drove through a part of downtown where new metallic apartments jutted into the skyline, mimicking the view of the mountains. Traffic swarmed and coughed under the city's haze, and healthy-looking young people rode bikes through the streets, past the homeless who curled under wilted cardboard. Tomi sat beside me, looking out the window. As we neared the library, he leaned over me like a puppy about to pee.
"See that house?"
he asked, pointing enthusiastically at a newly remodeled bungalow.
"I think that's Ronald's house, where my mom lives now."
I stared at the house, trying to imagine Natalie in a home like that. It didn't seem plausible. It had a clean, square lawn, and in place of an ancient cottonwood, infant trees were held upright with tiny ropes. The house even had a 3-car garage and a basketball hoop beneath an American flag. "I don't think she lives there," I said.
"Your mom wouldn't like a home like that."
But as the bus rounded the corner, Natalie's Honda pulled into the driveway, and we both grew quiet. At the central library, a security guard beneath a string of enormous Colorado flags greeted us. The wide space was cool with marble floors. Tomi flicked my purse strap as I searched the database for Azteca Starship. We learned from the back of book one that this volume included a sacrifice in space. We both had many questions, like, where does blood spurt in zero gravity? And are jaguar teeth and obsidian spikes still the preferred weapons? I wrote the author's name on a white square of paper and told Tomi to follow me. We zigzagged in and out of aisles, our chins tilted upward until we eventually stood before our shelf, the whole of the Azteca Intergalactic series before us.
"I don't understand," I said, looking at my paper. "It should be right here."
Tomi jumped to see higher.
"It's not?"
"No, it's missing."
"This sucks," said Tomi. "Of course it's gone."
He kicked the shelf, his puffy shoe sliding off, exposing his white sock. His dark eyes were fixed on a certain point, and it appeared he was searching the bookshelf behind me, but he wasn't. He looked directly at my face.
"Cole, what happened to your tooth?"
"Excuse me?"
"Your tooth."
Tomi pointed to my mouth.
"I saw it was gone when we were reading. I didn't want to say anything. My mom says I should ignore things like that."
The last person to say anything about my tooth was the dentist at La Vista, who told me he could replace it. Might as well take advantage of free dental, he had said. I felt inside my mouth, the black space of my long-gone molar. I swallowed it when I crashed a car.
"That car you stole?"
I nodded.
"Why did you do that?"
"I don't know. I used to drink a lot, but I'm not that way anymore." Tomi turned his face to the side, bowing his head like he suddenly understood something very important. He seemed worn down, old beyond his years. He almost looked like Manny.
"My mom told me you stole from me."
"Yeah," I heard myself say. "I did that, too." I searched the bookshelf, everything an endless line of colorful spines. When I looked back at Tomi, his face had shifted, his dark brown eyes suddenly appearing far away.
Stay here, I said. I'll ask a librarian.
I waited in line for the reference librarian, an older Chicano with a heft of gold around his neck. He had porcupine hair the color of burnt firewood. When I finally reached his desk, he told me Azteca Starship was nowhere to be found. He then pushed up his shirt sleeves and waved a coverless book in my face.
You like this one better. Have you read it?
I don't know what that is, I said.
Probably because you're too young. It's a great one, Hita.
I walked away from him and peered down the aisle where Tomi had been. He was gone. I called back to the librarian.
I was with a little boy, my nephew.
Have you seen him? The librarian shrugged.
Prunes.
What?
Maybe he needed to use the shitter.
No, I said nervously. He was just here.
The librarian laughed from his gut.
Back in a flash.
After I watched him calmly walk to the front desk, I searched for Tomi in the kids' books, the archival stacks, and the empty men's bathroom. Tomi? I kept saying until my voice became a frantic yell. I checked outside around a brass statue of children holding hands and ran over to the picnic tables along the parking lot, but he was nowhere. Had he run away or been kidnapped? I pictured Tomi clumsily climbing into a stranger's white van, an armful of Twizzlers as bait. Panic had set in, my heartbeat riding my veins.
Tomi! I screamed. Please come back!
The librarian had come outside with a security guard, and both men had the stiffened posture of those delivering bad news. I approached them, and the librarian placed his right hand on my shoulder.
Bad news. Rick here thinks he saw him leave.
Leave? I said. Leave where?
How did you lose him?
The security guard asked.
Lose him? No, he was just here. His name's Tomi, and he's 10. He has dark brown hair and glasses and these big shoes.
I felt something like hiccups in my chest.
He's too little to be alone.
The librarian and security guard shared a look. It wasn't good.
Can you think of anywhere he'd go? A friend's house or a park?
It's nighttime. He doesn't know anything.
Ma'am, the security guard said.
Have you been drinking?
Are you serious?
He said.
I've seen you before. I know how you Northside girls are.
Aye, come now, said the librarian.
She doesn't seem too messed up.
People coming out of the library had turned to look at us. A slim woman in pink spandex holding her toddler on her hip spun around so that her daughter faced the brick wall.
That's when I knew where Tomi had gone. That wasn't me, I said. You must have me confused with someone else.
There was a night a long time ago when I didn't drive myself home wasted from a party. I sat in a cab's passenger seat, marveling at the ribbons of green and blue city lights. It could have been the haze of weed, the heaviness of liquor, but I felt submerged, as if I had finally gotten to the real city, the ground floor, the place where everything is born. I asked my driver what was the strangest place in Denver he'd seen, the worst area. I thought he'd say my neighborhood before it changed, but he didn't. He said, Cherry Hills. All them mansions give me the creeps. It's like the entire neighborhood. The whole city died in its sleep. That's how I felt as I stood on Natalie's new white porch, and equally ashamed and afraid at the sight of Manny's truck out front. I knocked hard on the door. A middle-aged white woman answered in hiking clothes. She kept the chain on as she spoke.